You're listening to the Pocket Coven podcast,
where we explore the magical and mystical
and where they intersect with the wide world of mental health.
I'm Amber Lenore, a pagan creative arts therapist.
And I'm Callie Little, a pagan emotional support witch and artist.
We invite you to listen, connect, and deepen your relationship to magic.
And to yourself.
We're the coven in your pocket.
Welcome to the Pocket Coven podcast. We are recording remotely with a very special person. Callie, would you mind giving our guests a little intro?
I would love to introduce our amazing global coven to one of our over the seas pals, Rowan Rain, who is an incredible magic maker, and we'll get into all the titles soon. But among other things, you may have heard Rowan's music on one of our most recent episodes. They have all kinds of projects in the works. Amber and I know this beautiful human from their incredible astrology readings, and we're so excited to talk about the stars with them today. So thank you so much for being here, Rowan.
Thank you so much for having me. It's truly a delight.
Yay. As we often forget our new tradition, we are definitely pulling a card right at the beginning of this episode. Amber, what deck are we working with today and what's our card?
Yeah, we're working with the Thoth deck.
Ooh, T-H-O-T-H. We haven't used this before.
No, the Thoth is, it's really spicy. It has all the descriptions at the bottom, like strife, rotting, or you know, has all of these words that I don't necessarily find that correspond to the cards, but Aleister Crowley did. So it's an interesting. Oh, okay. We got the tower. We got the tower.
The tower.
Oops, oh, all towers.
Oh.
I mean, I don't usually expect to see the tower when we're pulling for the podcast. Callie, why do you think we got such a heavy-handed card?
Well, you know, listeners of the podcast who've been around for a long time will know that I love the Tower card. You know, this is a card that's all about you have built this whole life, maybe, or a system of beliefs, and it's very earthly, it's practical, it makes sense. But if you keep building up and up and up into the sky, eventually you transcend the earthly plane. And that's where the tower comes in. It's deconstructing these more practical pieces, these building blocks, so that we can really transcend into a new part of life. And people are afraid of the tower, which makes sense because change is very scary. But I think that the tower is a beautiful card. And I'm so curious, Rowan, if this has any attachments to the very weird shit that's happening in the sky right now.
So in a way, we have kind of just started to come out of this period of about 3 to 5 years of really, really heavy, intense Capricorn and Aquarius-based transits, particularly in Capricorn, those later degrees. As some people may remember, in the beginning of 2020, we had the great conjunction of Saturn, Pluto, and Jupiter, all in the early degrees of Capricorn, I believe. And we have kind of just had this onslaught of continuing energy and these continuing transits and these continuing kind of weird planetary races and battles and dances since then. And earlier this year, right around the end of 2021, coming into 2022, Venus entered Capricorn and then went through her retrograde cycle. And a lot of that retrograde cycle happened around the same degrees that were happening in 2020, these same degrees that keep getting activated in Capricorn particularly. And then once Venus left Capricorn, she entered Aquarius, where she then was under this condition called besiegement, where basically the two malefic planets, Saturn and Mars, were sandwiched around Venus, and they just kept dancing together for, I want to say, a whole month. I'd have to look back at it again. But Venus just finally exited Aquarius and ingressed into Pisces on the 5th of April, so last week. And it's kind of like a huge breath of fresh air, because even though Jupiter has been in Pisces since the end of last year, Venus hasn't really been able to take advantage of any of that juicy Piscean goodness. And we can get into, you know, why those planets and those signs are particularly important and all that sort of stuff later on. But I actually saw someone, and I really wish that I could remember off the top of my head, but it was someone online talking about how sometimes when you leave an incredibly traumatic situation and you experience safety for the first time, that's when all of the symptoms actually start to show and come up and arise for you. So sometimes people will come up in, you know, they'll have this experience, and then they'll come to a point of safety, and then they'll be so confused, like, why is all this happening to me? I feel like I finally, you know, came out of the shit, you know, the muck and the mess. So I feel like this is really kind of that illustrated perfectly.
Yeah, that sounds like a tower as hell to me.
Yes, yes, yes. I'm thinking of the card that comes after the tower, which is the star. And in the star, we can see rest and recovery, because now we can feel the impact of the tower's demise. It's only in the aftermath of the tower that we can really tend to our pain.
Oh, I like that. I'm imagining, you know, kind of ascending into the star and then looking down beneath the clouds and seeing the tower you climbed crumbling. Mm. It's very scary to lose the ground that you've had that's brought you to the point that you're at in your life. So I know that right now is a huge moment of transition for a lot of people, especially, and it makes sense with Venus being so present right now, a ton of people are having huge relational shifts. I know that my clients are facing a lot of major transition periods. So if you get this, you know, if we're in your ear right now, whatever your tower is, if you are in a new part of your life and you're coming into maybe softness, maybe the hard work is just beginning, maybe it's very scary, I think that this card is saying you are on the right path. You know, the tower is not one of the first cards. It's not one of the last cards. It's pretty in the middle. And it is saying you're getting there, you know? This is just one part of your journey, and it's big, but there's more to come.
Also very much in the way where when people experience trauma, I know that personally people have talked to me and be like, oh, well, aren't you glad for what you went through because it made you who you are today? And my response to that is always like, no, I'm not glad that this traumatic thing happened to me. I'm not glad that any of these things happened to me. But I can't go back and change it. And that's a lot of how I feel about the tower. I actually pulled, so two funny things. I have a song on one of my most recent albums from a couple years ago called The Tower that's about my experience in, you know, winter 2018 when I drew the tower every day for a series of 12 days before I got anything else, and it freaked me out. And I drew the tower this morning for a friend, and it was using Yoshi Yoshitani's The Tarot of the Divine, or the Fairy Tale Tarot. And I love that deck, the tower in that deck is Rapunzel falling from the tower, being struck by lightning by, you know, her evil stepmother or the witch, depending on which variation that you're reading. And I think about that. It's like, you know, there is, you know, in the original story, there is the happy ending in the end. She does find her true love. They do find each other again. But in that moment, you know, I don't think that anyone would feel grateful for being struck from a tower by lightning and falling into a field of thorns or anything along those lines. But ultimately, it happens, and then we change, and we can't go back. We can only, you know, move forward and recognize that, well, if you're in the rubble, it's probably time to reassess and move on.
I would love, at the end of this episode, to have listeners listen to your song, The Tower, if you would be so gracious as to send it to us.
I totally can, yeah.
Beautiful. So, Amber, I know you have some questions for Rowan.
Yes, yes. So I have two questions that I am very eager to ask. First, I want to know if you identify as a witch. And second, I want to know what astrology is. To me, astrology has always felt like magic combined with math, and any kind of math is difficult for my brain. even as an academic, I am much more on the qualitative side than quantitative. So numbers is just honestly not that interesting to me, but I could benefit from learning because I like astrology. So first though, tell us, are you a witch? And then after that, what the fuck is astrology?
Oh my gosh. Also, like, such big questions. I feel like you could have an episode each on either one.
I know.
Yeah. So I do not self-identify as a witch. It's a term that if people apply it to me and it means that we can have generative conversation and relationship build off of that, great. I'm not opposed to it. I have very dear, near and dear to my heart, family members and friends who do self-identify as witches. And I think all the power to anyone who identifies that way. But I do not. It is a somewhat recent decision that I made to like fully sever my ties to identifying as a witch. Really, honestly, I cannot talk about in full right now because there are so many different complexities and aspects of history that I would need to go into. But essentially, the way that I look at it is that language is consistently changing and evolving. But if language changes and evolves, it helps for us to know what that is evolving from or what the original conditions were. English is a monster Franken language that makes very little sense and does not actually originate from a singularly intact culture. It originated as a trade language between multiple different peoples who did not have the best of relationships at times. It has a lot of different external influences and thus is a very poor language for describing things that come within a cultural context or things that must be described within a communal sense. You know, if you ask me, like witch is one of those terms where it doesn't actually describe what you do necessarily. There are so many different definitions and so many different ways that people understand that word to the point where it is not productive for me to identify that way because I can identify using other words that tell you more accurately what it is that I do and kind of who I am in a way. Similarly to how I kind of describe it like this, I identify as a magic user. And a magic user is an umbrella term that I would use, similarly to how queer is an umbrella term, to describe a wide variety of different people who use magic intentionally. That also includes the term sorceress professional, of which I do consider myself one, although I'm still young, I'm still early in my professional years. But I compare it to that of using the term medical professional. So a medical professional is an umbrella term that encompasses a lot of different things. But you wouldn't go to a heart surgeon if you have a foot problem, and you wouldn't go to a pediatrician if you have geriatric care needs. So the term describes what it is you do. And because witch is such a nebulous term that really doesn't have a concrete or widely understood or common definition, I don't use it to describe what it is that I do. So instead, I might describe, depending on what I'm talking about. So I do identify as an astrologer. It took me a long time to actually identify that way. I identify as a seer. A magic user is really what I say, because English is an imperfect language and the cultural context that my magic comes from. The sorceress professional roles were severed due to colonial and imperial impacts on, you know, all European peoples, but especially of the places where my magic usually comes from. So that's a very long-winded answer, but that's how I identify. And then I'm so sorry. This is going to be an equally complicated.
I love it.
Okay, good.
Well, I mean, let me reflect for a moment. That way you know where you're at in time and space. So I did know that you don't consider yourself a witch anymore, at least. And I wanted to address that on the pod because I think you actually have great reasons for not identifying as a witch. And the way that you hold history and language in balance is so expansive and needed in spiritual community, I think. And I noticed that nowadays when we say witch, we're referring to the reclaiming traditions or neo-paganism, mm-hmm. and that's not very old.
No.
And while I do identify as a pagan and often as a witch, I recognize that both of those titles are somewhat mm-hmm. divorced from their roots. The creators of Wicca embellished mm-hmm. or fabricated history in order to advance the movement. And in my opinion, it, like, probably give it some legitimacy. Like, if it's very ancient, then it's very, very real. I think it's just as cool and as real, even if it isn't super ancient in the ways that Wicca would have, at least at one time, you know, what they painted, right? So I do think the title of witch is accessible, especially for folks who don't have access to academia and to understanding all of the nuanced history. And I really see you as someone who can do both of those things at once, you know, who can validate the title of witch as important because it is, and also just like, you know, dream of new ways of identifying. I love it, Rowan. And I appreciate the way that you're able to like be different and also not make it like, oh, you shouldn't do that anymore. You're like very nuanced about it. And I love seeing that in the cultural consciousness.
Me too. And I definitely want to have you back on so we can really get into that conversation, because I know there are so many people who are like, ooh, talk about that more right now as they're listening. And I feel the same way. You know, I have so many thoughts on it. And I, like Amber, like just want to validate. I love that you're like, that one's not for me, but I see you. I respect you. I'm something else. And I want to bring that conversation to the table. I want to share thoughts.
So like, even on that topic, and we would have to get so much deeper into history than we can in this time. Like, you can trace the lineage of the word witch with the lineage of the progression of neo-paganism and paganism in the modern sense as well. Like, even, you know, Starhawk's definition of magic and Starhawk's, you know, cosmology and really the fundamentals that created the reclaiming tradition of modern witchcraft comes from Dion Fortune's specific brand of Wicca, and which of course then comes from Gerald Gardner's brand of Wicca, which is influenced by the Golden Dawn and the theosophical movements, which is influenced by spiritualism. There's a whole continuum of understanding, where did this come from? Why was it used strategically? My godfather and uncle, once when I was younger, told me that when I still did identify as a witch, told me that I couldn't identify as a witch because I was not initiated into a Wiccan tradition. He later backtracked on that, and I love him. He is still like, he's one of the biggest influences in my life and one of my most influential magical teachers in my life. And, you know, earlier we were chatting about it and he said, well, but I understand that originally the word witch was in a negative context. And again, we'll get into that later, but he explained to me the rationale that he used and why he understood that historical use and the language and why he's still identified with it today. And at the end of the conversation, I was like, yeah, that's great. I mean, I'm still not going to identify that way, but like, it also helps me to have way more compassion for people not of my generation, of my parents' and my grandparents' generation, who really did a lot of work to destigmatize that word and to destigmatize the idea of magic and paganism just generally. And I think that there can sometimes be this tendency to be like, oh, well, you don't like the word witch, you're problematizing it. Now it's problematic to call yourself this or something. And the world is just far more nuanced for any of that.
I mean, yes, and definitely into the future. And also, I'm going to redirect us back to astrology. Rowan, what is astrology? What is it? What the fuck is it? Break it down for us.
Okay, I have notes. because it is a little bit easier actually to describe than trying to define magic or you know, some of these other aspects. But so I have two major definitions. My first definition, I'll walk you through it and then I'll break it down piece by piece to look at what the words mean. I'm really interested in meaning and language, and magic is meaning and all those sorts of things. So astrology is the skill of observation and interpretation of the movements and relative positions of celestial bodies through the zodiac from a geocentric perspective. Okay, so let's break it down.
Wow, good job.
I prepared. I was like, how am I? I know they're going to ask me to define astrology. I don't know how the fuck to do that. Let me try and figure it out. So that's what I came up with. And then, of course, I do have a kind of rephrased, simpler definition after I break this down. So astrology, the observation and interpretation, pretty straightforward, of the movements and relative positions. So that means what sign each planet is in and what aspects that planet makes to the others. So people might be familiar with the terms conjunction, opposition, square, trine, sextile. You know, there are some other aspects too, but those basically indicate mathematical angles of what position or how these different planetary bodies or celestial objects interact with each other in the sky. Then celestial bodies, what does that mean? It's a term that encompasses the many different objects that we observe in the sky. That includes the planets, the sun, the moon, asteroids, and certain other points. We also tend to look at intangible points. So those are things like the nodal axis, the north node and the south node. Those aren't physical bodies. They're actually points that are calculated based on the electromagnetic pull of the, or interplay between the Earth and the Moon. And those influence the eclipse cycles. It all does have a purpose, even when they're not physical beings. But, you know, there's also the Arabic lots and the parts, but there are also what people are probably more familiar with, the four angular points of the natal chart. So that would be the ascendant or the rising, the descendant, the midheaven, and the immunis coli or the nadir, sometimes called the IC. You'll often see it as IC on your chart. And of course, those points are calculated using math. Amber, I'm horrible at math. I actually didn't take any math during college because I tricked my way through that system and it did not serve me well. But I do like to say that I have a really hard time with math and I have a really hard time with time. But when it comes to astrology, I actually understand the concepts of time and math better through engaging with this practice, this study. And that's partially because linear clock time is a bullshit colonial invention. And the only true time that exists is planetary time. So just putting that there. Anyways, so it is the movement and relative positions of celestial bodies through the zodiac. What is the zodiac? The zodiac is 12 signs, each of which corresponds to a 30-degree section of the ecliptic. So the ecliptic is a circle. When you see that circle chart that a lot of people feel really intimidated by and like, I don't know what all these things mean or these points, that circle is a visual map of the celestial sphere that basically contains the Earth's orbit around the sun. So what that means from our perspective is it basically traces the movement of the sun's path through the sky throughout the entire year. Because the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, but that's not all, right? Because the position changes slowly day by day, which is why we have things like Newgrange, this Neolithic monument where on the winter solstice, the rising sun shines directly into this central chamber, but it doesn't shine all the rest of the days of the year because the sun moves day by day through that 365 roughly degree or day cycle. So the ecliptic is basically the space created where we connect all the different points in the sky where the sun passes throughout the year. And the sun always moves along the ecliptic, but the planets don't. The moon and the planets don't. But they stay really close because, like the Earth, we're all orbiting around the sun at the center of our solar system. So the zodiac is the term for the full range of space that we can observe the sun and all of the other celestial bodies from our perspective on the Earth's surface. And that's what geocentric means. It basically just means Earth is the center, unlike the heliocentric model, which places the sun at the center of the solar system, which is true. It's just, you know, I think that we can kind of all agree, like just because something is true objectively doesn't mean that there also aren't other subjective truths alongside that. We're all on the Earth's surface. That's all we can do. So to rephrase that in the words of the great Chris Brennan of the Astrology Podcast, astrology is the study of the movement and correlation between celestial bodies and earthly events. So that is my very long-winded way of describing that. What do you think?
Yes, I love it. I think it's a fantastic container. I love that you're able to find a concise container for such a complicated topic. So then that brings me to the next step. I guess I didn't say this in my two-part. I guess it's a three-part question. How do you think that the study of astrology, the practicing of astrology, informs magic or vice versa? How does that connect us to magic? How do we facilitate magical practice with astrology?
So this is a really interesting question because I think a lot of people see astrology and magic kind of like the square rectangle rule. Like, you know, not all magic is astrology, but all astrology is magic. When that's not really accurate. They're kind of more like a wonky Venn diagram where there are parts of magic that are inherently intersecting with astrology. And there are parts of astrology that are inherently intersecting with magic. But the two fields are fundamentally different. And you do actually find a lot of people who identify, you know, more commonly as magic users, but they don't identify as astrologers. But you also find astrologers who don't identify as magic users, who have no engagement or even interest in practicing magic, which is totally fine. But you find a lot, like in the past couple of decades, there's been this big resurgence. In the past 10 years, actually, there's been this huge resurgence of astrological magic. And there's also been a resurgence of interest in traditional astrology as well. And I think that's really big because modern astrology really divorced a lot of the really inherently magical aspects from like the older traditional things. So I guess I feel like there's four main ways that astrology and magic intersect in that Venn diagram. First and foremost, and like going back to its origins, it's a form of divination. It's predicting events based on, you know, what has happened prior. Western astrology, there's many different types of astrology. There's Vedic, Chinese, Mayan, you know, ancient Irish, even though we don't actually have resources for it anymore. And when I speak about astrology in this way, I actually want to be very clear. I'm talking about what's called, and I'm putting this in air quotes, Western astrology or tropical astrology. It's not actually Western. Western is an imperialist construct to begin with. But Western astrology basically comes from the Levantine area. So like that what we might call like Mesopotamia, like the Babylonian era of that particular intersecting Southwest Asia, North Africa, and where Europe kind of dips into that little lip. And the first evidence of astrology comes from about 4,000 years ago of lunar eclipse omen predictions on cuneiform clay tablets. So a lot of these basically focus on this happened the last time that a lunar eclipse happened. Ergo, we can predict, we make a divination or a prediction about the future that this is going to happen because of that. So astrology as divination is kind of like the primary way that I would see astrology functioning, but also magical astrology functioning.
It seems with that description that you're describing more of the universal seasons. It sounds very Wheel of the Year to me.
Oh yeah. I mean, that actually we get the Wheel of the Year, which is depending on like the Wheel of the Year in terms of like as a neo-pagan construct is a neo-pagan idea. It is very heavily based on a lot of different traditional cultures because we do live in a spiral time and we do experience the same seasons over and over again. But the solstices and the equinoxes are based on the ecliptic. There's this thing called the Tropic of Capricorn and Cancer, which kind of, well, I won't get into that because that's a little bit more, I won't get into that hole. But the equinoxes always occur at 0 degrees. Spring equinox is at 0 degrees of Aries. Autumn equinox is at 0 degrees of Libra. And then the solstices are at 0 degrees of Cancer and Capricorn, respectively. And then the cross quarter dates that we use, it's a traditional cosmology in the Gaelic worldview, but it also has been kind of absorbed into modern neo-paganism and Wicca because of Gerald Gardner and Dion Fortune's attempts to recreate or reconstruct older Anglo-Saxon and English Brythonic methods of engaging with their seasons and their locality. So Beltane or Beltane is at 15 degrees of Taurus. Lunasa is at 15 degrees of Leo. Samhain is at 15 degrees of Scorpio, and Imbolc is at 15 degrees of Aquarius. So you get this situation where you've got a cardinal axis for the equinoxes and solstices, and then a fixed axis based on the cross-quarter dates. Fixed and cardinal refer to the quality of the signs, and that's another way that you can describe the signs. But ultimately, it really is making sense of our seasons, and it is making sense of the way that our Earth turns and moves around the sun and that relationship between those celestial bodies. So that's absolutely it, like 100%. Like our experience of seasonal shifts, depending on your bioregion, like, you know, this is mapped up and aligned, like the cross-quarter dates are aligned to that bioregion. It basically is one and the same in certain ways.
You have three other ways that you speak about these things as well. I would love to hear about it all because you know so much about astrology. And I know that for me, getting a reading from you after I heard Amber's review of her amazing astrological chart reading from you, everything made so much more sense for me.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. I feel like I actually know very little about astrology in comparison to the depth of knowledge that is out there. I've only been studying astrology seriously for like a little bit under a decade now, which sounds like a long time, but at the same time isn't in the grand scheme of things at all. There's so many different things that you can learn about. But yeah, when it comes to astrological magic and the intersection of astrology and magic, like I said, you can view it as a form of divination, like prediction of events based on celestial movements. But the other main way that I see it coming up is through determining timing to do certain things. So most people who are engaging in a magical practice for the first time will look up the sky and be like, oh, wow, where's the moon? What phase is the moon in? That's usually people's gateway, the gateway drug to astrology. First thing you know, you're looking at the moon phase, and next thing you know, you're drawing up an electional chart for when you're going to get your hair cut. Like, it's just a slippery slope. But yeah, whether it's, and that goes, so electional astrology is the term for the branch of astrology that deals with looking at favorable timings to do certain things. So you also get a lot of gardening based on astrology, but also the phases of the moon. Amaya Rourke is a phenomenal person doing a lot of work around that. They just came out with a new course on gardening with astrology, and I so want to take it, but I can't right now. But so in addition to those two main ways that astrology shows up, you can also see it in remediation work. So astrological remediation is a really big thing in Vedic astrology, so the astrology of Southeast Asia and the Indian subcontinent. And it usually involves mitigating challenging aspects of the chart by providing balance to overwhelming placements. And that's a whole other topic that we could get into. And then the final way that I see this working is through what people tend to call astrological magic, which is essentially combining the methods of timing and the aspects of remediation, like how to make things a little bit less intense, and divination in some ways, like which is tied into timing. You basically, I've heard one of my friends described it as tempting fate in a way. And there's a whole discussion in the astrological community about how much fate plays a role and how much determinism plays a role in your natal chart. Because it can really lead to people being like, oh, well, this is the way I am. This is what my chart said. And it can become very limiting in some senses, or people can get overwhelmed by anxiety around like what's going to happen when this transit happens. You can do things like perform certain rituals to appease certain planets or petition certain planetary entities or energies to do things for you or be in relationship to them. That's usually the way to go. I mean, and just generally in working magic with other beings in general, relationship building and then helping each other out is significantly easier than just demanding things of spirits or planets. That could involve things like the creation of talismanic materia or particular objects that are made with a particular election in mind, or, you know, aligning yourself with particular aspects or correspondences to a planet to embody that planet's energy. There's a lot of ways that it can kind of ripple out in that way.
So it sounds like astrology is incredibly dynamic, and we can use a lot of different kinds of awareness in order to really drop in to working with astrology. So I actually had a client ask me recently, Rowan, how to figure out their rising sign if they don't know their birth time. You know, they've called the hospital, they've looked at the birth certificate, there's no birth time. And I know that an acquaintance of mine uses sort of like almost a personality test and assessment to kind of see where things are and to ask people like, well, do you know generally what time of day you were born? Do you have any suggestions for people who really want to figure out their rising sign but don't know their birth time?
Yeah. Book a chart rectification reading with an astrologer who provides that service. I do not provide that service. I have not been trained in it. It is delightfully mysterious to me in the way that all things are when I don't know how to do them. And chart rectification is basically the process by which an astrologer will, you know, it's kind of like that, kind of like a personality test, but also much more so like looking at events from your early childhood, events from your life, seeing how they map on to the events of that might play out in a chart, because that can be determined as well. I think a major disappointment in the modern astrological tradition is kind of the way that it's been divorced from the tangible, real ways that we can use it and see it play out in our lives. It's kind of become more of like a psychological, like, look at the different parts of yourself. I don't know. It's disenchanted in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who will get really freaked out about their horoscopes. You know, they'll go on the pattern and see that something's coming up or whatever, and they get really scared about astrological seasons. Do you have any advice for that?
So that my initial instinctual reaction was to say, well, the more you learn about something, the less scary it becomes. But in this case, I don't think that's true. A, because some with astrology, you can just keep learning, like kind of forever. It's great, but also like really daunting and overwhelming, especially if people are already overwhelmed and daunted by the amount of technical jargon and like really complicated sounding things that require you to already have a background in this aspect of astrology or in this aspect of, you know, history or whatnot. Yeah, I don't know. In terms of like being scared of particular seasons or transits, I think that going over it with a professional astrologer and going over your particular natal transits can help a lot because of the demystification of what can actually go on, but also because then you can work with someone to look at remediation or to look at potential ways that you can mitigate the more damaging or harmful aspects of a particular transit. When it comes to like the astrological seasons, like the solar season, so like we're in Aries solar season right now, or when someone says like, oh, it's Pisces season, that just means that the sun is in Pisces. I think just like what I would recommend is don't focus on the planets. If you're freaked out by like a particular season, like focus on your animate environment and get to learn to love the season that you're in, like what flowers are blooming and like what the weather is like, because that will help you have an animate relationship to your local place and like the area. And it stops being about like, oh my God, what are these giant planets in the sky going to do to wreck my life? And it's more like, oh wait, I actually have very little control over the planets. In fact, I have no control at all whatsoever about their movements. They're going to do what they're going to do. The best thing you can do is, I don't know, I guess with anything that you're scared of, make sure that you have support and you're well-resourced before going into it.
My thought hearing your response to that, you know, hearing that if you're having, you know, these fears to learn more, and if you want to learn more about your chart, to book a session with an accomplished, you know, proficient reader, what I'm hearing is really similar to when people struggle with anything, you know, go learn more and go see somebody who can help you through it. You know, we don't get through this life alone, and having community is so sacred.
But also don't hyperfixate on learning as much as you possibly can with the idea that if you know everything, it will no longer be scary, because that's totally not possible. And I know that I'm just speaking from my own perspective there, where like if something freaks me out, I want to get really like really deeply acquainted with it to try and understand like, oh, well, why am I freaked out? What I've also learned in my past experiences, sometimes that just re-traumatizes me and doesn't actually help me be less scared of whatever it is that I'm dealing with. And sometimes being freaked out by something means that maybe it's not for me. So
yeah,
sometimes you need to take a step back.
I think taking a step back and letting yourself, you know, have a feeling and look at why it's coming up is really great advice. You know, I find that often things feel a lot scarier when they're in the back of our mind and we are trying to move forward while ignoring them. That's when they tend to be the loudest. Those things really want safety. They want to be looked at. So yeah, if astrology is freaking you out, maybe learn more, maybe look into learning about it and see if that, you know, satisfies some of your fear, but also maybe just take a break, undownload the apps on your phone. You know, don't worry about your horoscope so much as just noticing your everyday life. Because from my understanding, astrology is really about noticing. It's paying attention to the seasons of the self and of the world around us.
Totally. I'd also just recommend, like, if you do want to learn more and you know that it might be something that's freaky or triggering, or maybe you have certain aspects that make it difficult or uncomfortable to engage with astrology, go in with a friend. Or really, I would really recommend, like, you know, either listen to people who study this, or really book a reading with someone. And you can, if you book a reading with someone who's an astrologer and you say, I'm kind of freaked out by this and I don't understand it, or this scares me and I want to help, I want to have more information and I want to be reassured about this, I'm like, most people are fully willing to work with that. you know, it's kind of like anything, just communicate your needs and people will show up.
I wonder, what would you say for people to look out for in their chart, in timing, in terms of mental health? Like, are there certain transitions in the stars for, you know, times of emotional, mental anguish or times where we need to really be tuning into more self-care? Maybe we need to look at it for finding a therapist in a certain transit, you know? Is there anything that comes to mind for you?
Not necessarily. The moon and the lunar transits would be something I'd pay attention to the most, because the moon governs the emotional world, emotional body, and a lot of different aspects that have to do with not just emotions, but emotional security and safety. The moon often relates to the, you know, our experiences as a child. It can often also point to relationships and the condition of the relationship with the mother or the maternal figures in one's life. Yeah, I mean, that doesn't tend to be what I focus on primarily in my own understanding of astrology. But like in terms of astrology can be a really good tool in general for self-reflection. So an individual might have particular transits or particular placements to look at in, you know, especially when it comes to their mental health and their experiences with mental health. You know, I just read this great article recently about how there's been a scientific study that was done on the way that particular self-help and spiritual messaging impacts our self-centeredness or our selflessness. And I think that like anything, but particularly like anything within the realm of the spiritual, astrology can both be a really powerful tool for self-reflection, and it can also be a really powerful excuse for self-absorption. I think a lot of people get caught in that trap where they're just like, oh, I'm not a bitch, I'm just an Aries. But it's like, you know, that doesn't excuse anyone's behavior, you know.
Two things can be true.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Or you get like, you know, the classic story is like, instead of being scared of a particular season, people will be scared of a particular sign. Maybe they have like an ex who's a Cancer, and they're just like, fuck all Cancers. I hate Cancers. Cancers are a cancer on this earth. This is totally not my experience. I love Cancers. They're some of my closest friends. But it's one of those things where that's not a universal experience, and people are not their sun signs, and people have full, complicated, multifaceted charts. And also, you know, I think I've said this to both of you as well in my readings that I've done. The natal chart is a map to your potential experience of life, and the map is not the terrain. Like, you can't understand what it is to be someone or to have experienced the things that people experience unless you are living their life. There's beautiful conversations about what to do with twins, you know, twins who are born at possibly the exact same moment or share at least predominantly all of their placements, regardless of how far apart they are in time. It's like, twins aren't the same people, even if they're identical. And to suggest that is, you know, usually insulting to folks who have that identity and that experience. So it is one of those situations where, like, it is a really powerful tool for self-reflection. It is a really powerful tool for growth and change, not just looking at the planets, but also looking at progressions and transits and all the different ways that we can utilize astrology for our benefit, because, you know, it doesn't stop existing just because we stop paying attention to it, right? Like, and I fundamentally believe what made me an astrologer is just realizing, oh, this shit is important. And I can either choose to remain blissfully ignorant or unaware or kind of peripherally engaged, or I can go down the rabbit hole and really use this to my advantage in all the ways that I can. And like any tool, things can be misused or used inappropriately. So I think it really just means it takes discernment. Modern astrology really moved towards this character psychological based model of understanding astrology.
And it's very commercial.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, hugely, especially recently too.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that there is a lot of benefit in things becoming popular. You know, there's totally been a ton of internet chat about, is it even okay that all these TikTok users are describing themselves as witches? And I think there's so much power in these lesser explored, at least in the modern world, experiences, wisdoms, you know, whatever, traditions. there's a power in them becoming popular, people learning about them. We can really resurrect a lot of wisdom from older generations, ancestors. And also, we can really abuse things. Like, for example, yoga. You know, yoga was, as far as I know, and I'm not a scholar in this, so forgive me if I'm incorrect, but from what I understand, Indian folks came over to the United States to share this beautiful movement practice that was about, you know, health and connection and being with oneself. And unfortunately, we have commodified it to be about cute pants and being thin and going to a cool class that celebrities go to, you know, and instead of it being about connection, it's really about items and materialism.
And it's funny you mentioned that, actually. I worked I wasn't a yoga teacher. I worked the desk at a yoga studio for a while when I was in undergrad. And one of the first things I learned is that yoga is actually, there are the, I think it's the 8 limbs of yoga. God, it's been a really long time because I left the world of white industrialized, the yoga industrial complex, as it's called. But yoga isn't even singularly a movement practice. The asana path of yoga, like the physical movement, is only one of the limbs. And if you only have one of the limbs, you don't have the full body. And it's really interesting. Like, this is a perfect segue, actually, to talk about the transits that are going on right now, because this is big Neptune and Pisces energy. So I guess let me actually take a step back and break that down. So Neptune is an outer planet. It's one of the 3 outer planets, including Pluto and Uranus. And the 3 outer planets tend to be viewed as the generational planets. They're new. They're introduced into modern astrology. Neptune was only discovered in autumn of 1846. So it hasn't even been around that long in our understanding of astrology or astronomy, for that matter, because we can't see them with the naked eye. That's why they're the outer planets, including Saturn. Actually, outer planets just means they're outside the asteroid belt. That's a tangent. I don't need to get into it. So Neptune... Neptune is sometimes called the higher octave of Venus. Neptune is the planet that speaks to or governs over the correspondences of the realm of spirituality, unconditional love, kind of like collective consciousness, the unknown, the psyche, the depths of the submersive self, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. But it really fundamentally deals with transcendent experiences, spirituality, mysticism, things that are obscure or hidden or unclear in a lot of different ways. And Neptune, in its traditional, in its modern rulership, because again, Neptune is not one of the traditional planets, is ruled by or rules the sign of Pisces. So when Neptune is in Pisces, it's called domicile. It's at home. It is in the sign that it governs. Jupiter, as well, is a planet that rules traditionally both Sagittarius and Pisces. Jupiter ruled Pisces because, of course, at the time, there are reasons why Jupiter rules Pisces particularly, but Neptune is the modern ruler of Pisces, but the traditional ruler is Jupiter. And when those planets are in those signs, it's called domesticity, or they are domicile. They are at home. They're super comfy. It's part of what's called essential dignity, which basically is a term that describes whether or how comfortable a particular planet is in a given sign. There are some signs that align great with the energies of that planet. Like Neptune is all about spirituality and mysticism and unconditional love and the collective consciousness. Well, Pisces is the sign that deals with the unconscious and the collective and unknowns and unconditional love and spirituality and mysticism and all of these wonderful oceanic depths. So when Neptune is in Pisces, it's basically like that energy is amplified tenfold. And that's what is going on right now. So Neptune entered Pisces in 2011, and we can see a lot of ways that this current era, it will also leave Pisces in 2025, finally, when it enters Aquarius. And we can look at the ways in which this particular transit might be influencing us on a global level by looking at the last time that a particular transit occurred. So Neptune was only discovered in 1846, right? But Neptune entered Pisces in 1848. So it was only a couple years before Neptune ingressed into its home sign, the sign that it rules. And that period from 1848 through to 1862, that is the period in which spiritualism exploded in the Western modern world. So you have the introduction of seances and ghost photography. And these things didn't just emerge and become part of a fringe culture. They became popular and a normal and honestly, like, almost respectable thing to engage in. It was particularly popular with the upper middle classes. And you have this resurgence of interest in spirituality and magic and occultism. You get spiritualism, you get theosophy, you get basically a lot of the very white Western colonial frameworks that gave birth to the rise of Wicca and the neo-pagan movement of the 20th century and reclaiming and all of these different things that we engage with now, which of course, because of the way that colonialism and imperialist dynamics have, like, whiteness has a collective amnesia to it. We forget our roots, we forget our origins, we forget where these practices come from. We don't realize, but astrology can help us look back at that and be like, oh, the last time that Neptune was in Pisces, there was this explosion of interest in spirituality beyond, you know, modernity, beyond materialism, which had kind of only really emerged right before that during the Industrial Revolution. So if we see Neptune in Pisces there, this really is our first, you know, this kind of, in a way, is Neptune, the planet's, Neptune's return of discovery in a way. Like, we have a solar return every year when a planet returns to the same place. And when a planet returns to the same position of anything, that can be really important. A lot of people are talking about the Pluto return of the United States, for example, as a nation when it was constructed. Depending on the birth chart, there's a lot of people who talk about what the birth chart actually is. You can look at the way in which, you know, Rome collapsed when Pluto returned to when Rome was kind of created. There's a lot of different ways you can look at that. These things, when they return, they don't happen often. So when they do, astrologers and other people in general, we tend to kind of perk up and listen a little bit more. So this month in particular, we're experiencing a once-in-a-lifetime kind of transit that's going on that, very similarly, you know, we got to pay attention to. I know that Amber and I have connected very deeply on Selkies and the Selkie myth and the Selkie storyline. And in The Secret of Rowan Inish, which is one of my favorite films of all time, there's a line in there where one of the people says, one of the suspected Selkie, this dark one of the family, is asked, "Can you see the future?" And he says, "No, but I can see the past quite well, and the present sometimes too. And that's how I see my role as a seer in a lot of ways. And that's how I see my role as an astrologer. I can't see the future exactly, but I can see the past quite well. And the last time that Neptune and Jupiter had a major conjunction, shit got wild." So it's going to be really interesting to see on this coming Tuesday, April 12th, what happens the next time that Neptune and Jupiter conjoin. You know, a lot of astrology, we can use it for self-reflection, look at these transits, think, what was happening in this time of my life, and what can I kind of think about or reflect on as I move into a similar transit? None of us were alive the last time that the last Jupiter-Neptune conjunction happened. Our ancestors were. It occurred in 1856, during the height of the popularity of the spiritualist movement. So we can kind of look at this and kind of wonder, you know, there are a lot of other astrologers talking about what this could mean. And I'm sure I will not talk your ears off about it because we've already talked a lot. But I think it's going to be interesting. It's a really fun transit. It's one I've been looking forward to for a long time. So yeah, get some pleasure in and some mystical experiences on Tuesday, April 12th, 2022.
Well, I mean, Rowan, we want to hear you talk our ears off. You have so many beautiful thoughts and bits of wisdom to share with the world. And I know that so many of our listeners are going to be so excited to connect with you. Where can they find you? How can they work with you?
Absolutely. So I am, I have a website. It's my name, rowanrain.com. That's R-O-W-A-N-R-A-I-N, like the weather. Yes, I know. It's a ridiculous name, but it's mine and I love it. I'm on the gram, Instagram, at Selkie Seer, S-E-L-K-I-E. Yeah, there's an E at the end of that. Yeah, S-E-E-R. Just forgot how to spell for a second there. That's really it. I'm not super present on the internet. I tend to post sporadically. But I will be opening up my books for magical services for the first time again in 5 years. This Bieltina, this May 1st. And you guys actually get the exclusive on that. I haven't announced it anywhere else yet. So,
oh my gosh, you heard it here first.
You heard it here first.
And can people book astrological readings with you?
Yes, they can currently. Oh. But I don't have a way to do that on my website currently, which is what I'm working with. I am very technologically challenged in a lot of ways.
Me too. So it's okay.
Still figuring that out. I'll have it done by May 1st, though, hopefully, knock on wood. But yes, if you want to reach out to me on my Instagram and see what my availability is for readings before then, if you have a burning urgent question or really need to get your chart done, you can totally do that. And if I can't do that reading, I can certainly recommend people who can.
Wonderful. And where can folks get your music? Everywhere it is?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, my God. I completely forgot about music. Like, I wear a lot of hats. And as a youth, I compartmentalized a lot of my different selves, which is something I've been working on a lot as an adult. So shout out to that. Yeah, you can find my music at rowanrain.bandcamp.com or on, that's for all of my, like my full discography, but my most recent releases are available anywhere that you can stream or buy music. So, you know, Spotify, iTunes. Again, I'm real bad with the technology, but yeah, you can listen on whatever your preferred method is. And if you can't find my music on your preferred app or platform or whatever, let me know so I can change that. That'd be fun.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being here and for sharing your beautiful brain with us. And listeners, thank you for being here. Thank you to our amazing patrons who support this show, including Carly and A Witch and a Woodsman, who are our goddess tier subscribers.
And this is Amber coming in during post-production to add the end of this episode because we got booted off. You know, Rowan lives in Ireland. Zencaster is cursed. You know, just the different things that happen. So I'm coming in after Callie is finishing up the episode there to remind you to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, especially if you don't have the means or the interest in joining Patreon. That's okay. And I wanted to let y'all know that our bonus content for this week is going to be a little different than usual. And honestly, I think it's super cool and a nice little break from our bonus episodes, which are just, you know, shorter versions of the podcast. This week, we are going to give you a reading list compiled by Rowan that Rowan sent to me when we were first meeting online and becoming internet overseas friends. This reading list is so extremely comprehensive. It covers the essentials of magic, the essentials of movement, animism, birthwork, bee tending, story and mythology, the role of the seer, the role of the witch, the poison path, malevolence and protection, water magic, the horned god, Hecatean or Hecate-related witchcraft, and cultural magic, Jewish, Irish, Scottish, English, Slavic, and Greek. This document on a PDF is 17 pages long. So for those of you who have been wanting more reading and wanting more resources, Rowan has done probably a decade of research. And if you're one of our people on Patreon, that will be your bonus content for this week, available at all levels. So please enjoy that. And because I have the luxury of post-production here, I have a final note from Rowan on the astrology of April 12th. 2022, this Jupiter-Neptune conjunction, this big event that is happening. See how I struggle to even say astrological terms. And we are hoping to release this episode on that date so that way you can take advantage of this information and maybe do some ritual. So, as I said, I have this post-production note from Rowan that I think is really sweet. Rowan says, on Tuesday, April 12th, Jupiter and Neptune perfected their conjunction, which is to say that they aligned exactly with one another at 24 degrees of Pisces. However, they've been applying to this conjunction since the spring equinox and will remain within each other's sphere of influence until mid-May when Jupiter briefly enters Aries. Jupiter will later return to Pisces during his retrograde cycle, but won't conjoin Neptune again that exactly. Jupiter is the planet of expansion, growth, potential, and fortune, while Neptune is a planet of spirituality, mysticism, and the realm of the unknown. Both ruled by Pisces, their meeting is an emotional, dreamy, mystical experience of collective enchantment and creativity. You might find your psychic abilities get boosted around this time, or you get a burst of creativity from a spiritually potent source. This is a good time to pay close attention to your dreams. Do you already have a dream journal or a dream recall practice? If not, this transit is the perfect time to begin. However you feel and experience this transit, take a moment to sit in the awe of knowing that we are all collectively witnessing a celestial event that will never again happen in our lifetimes. What do you think the last Jupiter-Neptune conjunction was like for our ancestors? What do you think our future descendants will remember from this time? What do you think the next Jupiter conjunction will bring for those future ones? And with that, enjoy The Tower by Rowan Rain.
Brick by brick, you might as well make it quick if it's gonna all crumble to the ground. I guess I've gotta be the witness. And blood flows thick over my lips and down my thighs. I choose to believe my eyes, cause the reckoning can be vicious. My heart beats quicker and quicker, threatening to jump right out of my chest. The flames will dance and lick and flicker while they burn up my life and bring the night back to black. I know.